Blog Talk Radio.
Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life.
Song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? Okay, that's on my end. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Welcome to the airways of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. John, I was just basically giving our listening audience a little information as you being a up-and-coming star in this sustainability arena, because when we look across the landscape, and I know over the last 6 years since we put together a very, very extensive research data bank under Positive Change under our News and Events tab, we have very, very few African-Americans in this arena. So would you mind sort of sharing who you are, something about your educational background, and what brought you into this sustainability arena? And we'll sort of take it from there. Go right ahead.
Certainly, no problem. And thank you for having me on, Ronald. I really appreciate the invitation. I guess my journey started roughly 20 years ago at Morehouse College. I had an environmental studies fellowship program. I was studying under a woman named Dr. Hewitt at Morehouse, and we worked together on a pitch, Sustainable Dorms, which, you know, through the program that I was in, it was called the Associated Colleges of the South. Pitched that to Morehouse and didn't end up getting any traction with it, but I actually ended up getting the attention of an organization called South Face Energy Institute through that pitch. So that's where I ended up working when I graduated. South Face Energy Institute is located in Atlanta. I began doing home energy ratings, LEED certifications, working with Enterprise Community Partners, Green Communities certification. All of that I was doing as I was sort of waiting to move to California, actually, to start architecture school. So I had been accepted to architecture program out here in California. But then Hurricane Katrina happened. So when Hurricane Katrina happened, I was in Atlanta, and my family was all in New Orleans. And just so happened that year that the United States Green Building Council was hosting Green Build in Atlanta. So I go to Green Build, and, you know, the whole Brad Pitt team is there talking about redeveloping the Lower Ninth Ward and, you know, all these starchitects. I mean, Frank Gehry and, you know, big-time names, Tom Main, Bill McDonough, talking about what they're going to do in New Orleans. And, you know, no one actually had any on the ground knowledge there. So I kind of stepped up and I said, hey, you know, you're not going to be able to do that there because this community is there, and you can't do this there because this organization runs that area. And they're sort of like, you know, who is this kid? And I happen to be one of the only ones from New Orleans actually in the room. So almost right there on the spot, I got hired by an organization called Global Green, who was doing the, Pit redevelopment projects in New Orleans. So I forewent architecture school to come down to New Orleans and help with the rebuilding effort. So I'm down there doing construction management for them for about 2 years. And I think, you know, it was safe to say everything was a political matter. So I, you know, frequently in front city council, in front the mayor, and on these citywide energy policy task force. So it didn't take too long before I got recruited by a city councilwoman who was actually the head of the utility committee. So worked for her for a little bit and then ended up transitioning over to the mayor's office as the energy and environmental policy analyst there. And, you know, I was just sort of always in this right place at the right time kind of a thing, because as I'm at the city of New Orleans and I'm now the citywide energy policy analyst, the economic stimulus package came about, and next thing I know, I was the recipient of the Department of Energy's stimulus dollars. So I received an allocation of roughly $4 million to do with what I, you know, saw fit. So I was sort of empowered by Dr. Blakely and the mayor's team to come up with citywide sustainability proposals to invest these dollars into. So I chose three initiatives. I did a citywide energy efficiency commercial building program. I invested some of those dollars into some specific city programs. Did an energy efficient streetlight program. And then I did a revolving loan fund program for energy efficiency and renewable energy to make it affordable for low-income homeowners in New Orleans. I think that work, you know, is kind of what really started to kind of get me the most traction in New Orleans while I was there. I also did a lot of policy work. So I passed, I worked with a, you know, consulting team, and we passed two notable tax credits. The first was a 50% tax credit for solar, and the second was legislation to make that those tax credits transferable between entities such that a for-profit entity could take advantage on behalf of everyday citizens. So that's really what opened the door for these solar leasing models to sort of go gangbusters down there. And if you look back, I shared with you some reports in advance of this, so you saw some of the numbers.
Yeah, before you share with our listening audience, I want to sort of unpack what you just shared with our listening audience. First, he went to the house. We refer to it as Morehouse. A lot of my friends graduated from Morehouse. Secondly, it's time and space. He was in Atlanta. And if anybody knows Atlanta for the last almost 30 or 40 years, it has been the regional hub for the Southeast region for the federal government. Now, it's not Washington, D.C., but if you're going to do some business in with the federal feds and you're in the Southeast region, you usually end up going to Atlanta before you end up in Washington, okay? Now, with that being said, you did something that was quite amazing because you spoke up in a meeting, and this is something that I try to encourage our young African-American students to do. That is why I have been pressing so hard to get this particular podcast syndicated through the Urban Radio One Network, which is owned by Dr. Kathy Hughes in the 76 markets, because this information that you are sharing hits home. Because often our young people don't speak up when they're in rooms with folks who don't look like them on the collegiate level. Sometimes our young people are almost taught not to be aggressive. But I was one of those sort of speak up and speak out individuals myself, because I hail from Dillon, South Carolina, which is from a small rural town, but I played football. and I was and I played linebacker, and I also played defensive end on the collegiate level because I'm a Morgan State alumnus. I had a little short stint in the league, which they call it not for long, but better known as the NFL. So I understand the relationships between how you are socially conditioned as a young person to be able to speak up and speak out. You did that. You shared information with individuals about your hometown, which was New Orleans. And what was very interesting about everything that you're saying, at the same time that you were doing these things, there's a young man by the name of Van Jones, who a lot of people don't realize, had it not been for Van Jones authoring the Green Jobs Act, there would not be that tremendous growth in the solar sector as we know it today, because he took that to Congress, and he was able to get Congress to codify the Green Jobs Act. And until Congress codifies an industry, it doesn't grow domestically, because solar ain't new. It's been around since the space era in the early 60s.
Oh, yeah. We all remember Jimmy Carter putting solar up on the White House.
Oh, no question. So this industry did not grow until Van Jones was able to do that. And that legislation resulted in $500 million in workforce development training. Each state got $10 million, including the District of Columbia. So I want to put that history out there so people will understand the relationships of how things happen in space and time. Now, something that you did was very, 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 very interesting. You were able to get New Orleans designated as a U.S. Solar American City. And could you sort of speak about that process and that designation? Because what I want our listening audience to understand is we know New Orleans is in Louisiana, which is what they call a regulated market. And what that simply means is that the utility companies control the production of energy, the generation of energy, the pricing of energy. And what you accomplished for the city of New Orleans was basically in a regulated market where you were able to get renewable portfolio standard legislation passed. And that does not happen everywhere, especially in the Deep South. So with that being said, I want you, John, to go ahead and sort of elaborate that about that that process and what you went through in New Orleans in the different roles you play in getting the city of New Orleans designated as a sole American city.
Yeah, no problem, Ronald. And obviously this is a long story that I'm going to try to truncate into bullet points. You know, there were a lot of dips and turns, but I'd say one of the first dips, you know, when I was at Global Green and Brad Pitt was in town, we were really successful in leveraging his star power towards getting policy enacted. So here we are in the middle of the lower Ninth Ward building homes with 100% solar, geothermal, you know, almost entirely off the grid. And the local city council and, you know, the mayor and the planning department, and no one was pretty much, you know, there yet in terms of that level of technology being introduced to the city's grid and the city's built infrastructure. So the city permitting department didn't have, you know, their permits updated or their codes rather updated to do proper inspections. And then when we were trying to tie our solar into the grid, we ran into, you know, truncated and outdated net metering laws. So in effect, we had to go and lobby the city. We had to go and lobby the state to get these laws overturned and changed so that we could properly build our buildings. So that's where it really started. Somewhere along the way, A consultant by the name of Steve Shelton showed up, and he was working with the Department of Energy. He was well-connected in D.C., and this is while I'm at Global Green, and he told me about this Solar America Cities grant, but in order to get it, they needed matching funds from a local nonprofit. So I brought that to my job, my boss over at Global Green, and we had to match the funds with a grant from within our coffers. So we looked around at the projects we were working on, and I was most excited about our Solar Schools initiative because we had a Green Schools initiative that we were sort of outfitting some schools for solar, but there was not enough money to actually put solar up. I took that project and we used it as the matching funds to get the Solar Cities grant designation from the Department of Energy. Then a little later on, Entergy stepped in and I partnered with Entergy, the local utility, to launch a Solar Schools initiative. And, you know, that was how we really were able to get the utility to the table. And it became less of an adversarial relationship. And to this day, I have a good relationship with Entergy. I'm actually working with them on a project right now, doing solar. So, you know, we had to make ourselves a friend of the utility. And I think in so many jurisdictions, it becomes popular to beat up on the utility. But at the end of the day, these things won't happen without their involvement. I got that Solar Cities designation at Global Green. Then when I went to this work for the city, I sort of carried that policy work with me. Having that Solar Cities designation helped when later on those stimulus dollars that I was mentioning came about, because folks were already talking about everything we were doing on the ground there in New Orleans. You know, we were already sort of starting to look like, we were kind of coming out of the dark ages, so to speak, and seeing the light. You know, we were the poster children for climate change after Hurricane Katrina, but there was no, real sustainability, citywide policy or agenda happening to speak of until that time. So then, by getting that that focus, we took that then to the state, because now things are bubbling up in New Orleans. And you're right, there's two separate entities. There's Entergy New Orleans and Entergy Louisiana. And Entergy New Orleans is regulated by the city council. So that was the strength that we had in New Orleans, that we didn't necessarily have that same legislative power in the state. But by starting the momentum in New Orleans, we could sort of capitalize on that on a state level. So when we would show up in Baton Rouge, everyone's like, well, here come New Orleans, and you know what they're going to do. They got this and that and the third going on with this, renewable stuff. And, that's the kind of power that we had, that we were able to leverage to get things like that statewide tax credit. Those two tax credit pieces of legislation passed that I mentioned to you, which created a solar leasing boom in New Orleans. Companies who basically leverage solar leases for, basically low-income residents could just sign up for a lease and get solar for 80% off. It was unheard of because there was a federal tax credit of 30%. Statewide tax credit of 50%. You could.
Yeah, I think it went down to 26%, but I think in this new record
now it has. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's
been beat up. Yeah, since I've left, it's been whittled down to nearly nothing. But we had some glory days in there before they caught on to what we were doing. And they caught up. But we had some glory days in there where solar was gangbusters.
Okay, that is what has happened here in the District of Columbia, in our nation's capital. What happened was Mayor Bowser in 2016, she signed the first renewable portfolio standard legislation, which was at 50%. But we don't, I don't have to tell you the problem in the District of Columbia, they don't have any space. So very dynamic sister who is president of PEPCO here, Donna Cooper, I sat down with Mrs. Cooper as the proposals were being drafted for EV infrastructure for the district, because I attended quite a bit, all of the hearings that they had on the renewable portfolio standard legislation. And in 2018, an omnibus act of 2018 was passed by the district, which took it from 50% to 100%. But I want to sort of explain to our listening audience why, how this connects with your conversation. In the District of Columbia, when the city council sat down with stakeholders who have an interest in making a, what they call return on investment, ORI, okay, wrote into the state or District of Columbia law, not state, it's not a state, but the District of Columbia law, that for renewables, for wind, the hydrogenetics, that the PEPCO could buy their energy credits from outside energy generators. But for solar, it has come from the physical land mass of the District of Columbia. The problem is, after Mrs. Cooper, and I spoke with the head of their engineering staff at PEPCO here, she said, look, and as you said, the utility, you have to try to build a working relationship with folks. You can't alienate people if you're going to be thinking you're going to move forward in this arena. So she shared with me, her head of engineering, she said, look, Mr. Buffet, unless Mayor Bowser is going to invest $50 to $90 million in rooftop repair in wards 8, 7, 5, and 6, where we still have the largest low and moderate income customer base in the District of Columbia, she said, we got almost 400,000 customers in the D.C. inside the District of Columbia. She said, unless they're going to fix the roof, we'll never be able to offset the shortfall of D.C.-based solar. She said, now, this is what they're doing. She said, okay, our attorneys are sitting at the table when they replace structured this law. She said, we were at the table. So we're passing these fees, pass-throughs on our customer base on their utility bill. She said in 2017, because of shortfall of DC-based solar, we wrote a check for $15 million. Okay? And this was before this is after the first renewable portfolio standard legislation was signed into law in 2016, but they actually did start tracking the impact until the fiscal year 2017. So they signed the check, but they looked at what they will call, is referred to for our listening audience, they're called green renewable energy certificates. They're known as XRACs or RECs. They're traded on the commodities market every day. And if you have a shortfall and a high demand, because the utility company has to buy these credits from their customer base. And if you don't have enough homes, if you don't have enough NGOs, which we know is nonprofit organizations, colleges and universities, even though any college and university, their number two fixed cost, which we know is energy, if you don't have enough federal buildings with these PV systems on their roof, that are generating more energy and above of what's being used by that physical building or that household that PEPCO can buy those credits back from, then PEPCO is fined by the D.C. government. And that fine in 2017-18 jumped from a shortfall of $15 million to $26.1 million that Pepco had to write that check following year.
Oh, wow.
So what happened is the head of the Public Service Commission, this is Betty Ann Kane, came on this platform raising pure hell, breathing fire and brimstone with Mrs. Anna Skubin with a group called, it's now known as Neighborhoods United. They're across the country. They educate homeowners on how to form cooperatives to put PV systems on individual homeowners' rooftops. It's an educational piece. They got a $2 million grant originally when this whole thing got funded because Betty Ann Kane put her foot down. She said, look, this legislation with renewable portfolio standard law did not start in 2016. She said it actually started in 2012. And we've actually been allowing the district government to have some form of pass-throughs on our utility bills since 2012. And we have already allowed the city to collect over $76 million. But what has kept taking place, John, the D.C. City Council would go to the Public Service Commission and petition that $25 million, $30 million be moved to the general fund, and those funds were used for purposes for which they were originally not intended to do. Because under the law, when they passed renewable portfolio standard legislation in the district, they're supposed to have 100,000 low and moderate income residents reduce their energy bill by 50% by year 2030, whether it be through community solar, through subscription solar, or direct application of installing PV systems on the rooftops of the residents in the district. And from that, with the help of one dynamic brother here in Washington, D.C., Mr. Ted Tarbu, who is the director of the D.C. Sustainable Utility, is known as DCSEU, which is a private firm, even though they contract with the D.C. government and with the utilities. But Ted designed a program called the Solar for All program, where they use the AMI of the federal government versus the local AMI, and which is much higher, and it almost qualified every low and moderate income resident in the District of Columbia to be able to get a PV system on one's roof with no out-of-pocket money up front. They own the system from day one. The Department of Energy and Environment really didn't have to take the risks for the first 5 years. It was just greed, because they wanted to fund a green bank, Columbia, which they went in to, and this is what sort of the whole thing that blew it up at the Public Service Commission. When Tommy Wells, who used to serve on our city council here in Washington, D.C., moved over to become the director of the Department of Energy and Environment, they, in fact, wanted to start a green bank, so they went and put a request in for the Public Service Commission to raise $105 million over the next 10 years through these pass-throughs in order to help capitalize the Green Bank of Washington, D.C. She got the accounting division at the Public Service Commission to run an audit and found out they were raising $256.6 million, $156.6 million more than they had requested, $51 million than they had requested. Now, the reason why I'm going through this for our listening audience to understand is this is the pocket of issue, because not only have they put these pass-throughs or these fees on their electric bill, it's on the water bill and the gas bill. So this is a pocketbook issue, whether you're interested in sustainability, whether you're interested in saving the planet or not. But if you pay utility bills, that is why what John did in New Orleans was so unique, because Washington, D.C. is in a deregulated market. The DMV market area is blessed to be there. That means in the D.C., inside of the District of Columbia, because there's such a shortfall because the way the law is written, D.C. has the highest extracts trading values in the country. It trades at $435 for a kilowatt hour. Did you hear what I just said, John?
Oh, yeah. That is huge.
This is huge. So this has sped up gentrification and everything else because everybody's rushing to D.C. to buy in wards 8, 5, 6, and 7 because they can take advantage of these programs that they have here. They have the commercial PACE. They don't have the residential PACE program implemented, but they've implemented commercial PACE, which for our listening audience is the Property Clean Energy Assistance Program, which allows homeowners to borrow up to 35% of the property value in order to put in renewables, whether it's going to be replace the roof, windows, anything that's going to save energy. PACE is designed for that. And it's not based on your credit score. It's not based on the equity you got in the property. It's based on your property value. So it's a game changer for our community, but they're not educated around these issues to go down to the public hearings and raise hell about if you want to implement commercial PACE for the developers, you got to commit, you got to implement it for residential PACE, which wasn't done. So these are some of the things that I'd be
Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae, you know, I think the Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae and the second lien issue have just kind of drawn a line in the sand behind the residential. What'd you say?
Yeah, you knocked the ball out the park, brother. That is what the problem has been, is they've drawn a line in the sand about who is going to have first dibs if that property goes into foreclosure. And we had so many issues here in the District of Columbia because the solar third-party lead generation, the sales people, they went crazy in the district running, and everybody got a different story. But the long and short of this market is not on fire. It is bubbling at a volcanic. That is how hot solar is inside of the District of Columbia. So with that being said, I want to sort of connect the dots so our community can see the relationship about what you were able to accomplish in New Orleans. So go right ahead, John, and sort of share of where this is, what you're doing now in Los Angeles. And I know you did some things with Van Jones on the West Coast. So, because I want to let our community know, this kind of information is invaluable to hear the track in which your life has gone through in terms of you taking advantage of those opportunities, because this is the future. Renewables are the future. EVs are the future. And when we can talk about all the STEM education we want, but when we look at the fact, based on the data that's put out by the Solar Foundation, we only have, and I actually have the actual numbers, out of 9,000 solar installation design and workforce development training companies doing business in the U.S., we've got less than 30 African-American firms. Go right ahead, John.
Yeah, man, and that's, you know, still to this day a huge problem. And just as with anything else, you know, there's racial divides. And I think if you look up and down the line of most of the senior leadership of most renewable energy companies, you don't see too many black or brown folks. And you know, and that's a sad reality. And obviously, just as with anything else, there'll be the excuses of, well, maybe there's not enough qualified people. But we all know that's not true. And I think that's you know, the importance of what people like Van Jones are doing. Green for All's edict and their, you know, their ethos is all about, you know, literally making Green for All and making this something that is approachable and is, you know, readily received within our community, because our community is the most affected. I think one of the sort of passing the baton moments that happened for me was, you know, these conferences called Power Shift, where us sort of new school renewable energy people are working alongside environmental justice folks. And environmental justice is something that our community is no stranger to. And, you know, there's a long line of heroes in that space. Now, you know, the folks with, you know, the next generation coming with the solutions, I think, has to be kind of propped up by the environmental justice movement. So I just wanted to say that first. But, yeah, I met Van Jones when I was working at Global Green. This is probably back around 2006. And I became a fellow of Green for Alls. And my affiliation with them certainly helped me a whole lot in terms of making you know, inroads and getting traction with my work. I went to D.C. I was out there lobbying with them behind the Green Jobs legislation. I, you know, participated in numerous conferences and things of that nature, working alongside the Green for All team. So I continue to be active with them. Now I think the organization, you know, isn't as big as it was before, because just like with most things, there's these fads that come along, there's buzzwords, and, you know, everybody was all excited about green jobs, that buzzword, for a while. Well, when that buzz goes away, there's a tendency for the movement to die with it if you're not careful, and then only the soldiers at arms are still left in there fighting, and you know, the massive have kind of moved on. Well, you know, climate change ain't going to move on from us. I think, you know, as it gets more and more crazy with every generation, I think we all can see, well, you know, climate change, it ain't about to just go away. So whatever you want to call it, whatever buzzword you want to use to get the media talking about it, you know, we all got to work together to do that. So, you know, as I work with Van over the years, and, you know, I could see just how effective he is at fundraising. But, you know, I think Van would agree that, you know, his strength was really the soldiers that he assembled across the country, because, you know, there are a bunch of folk who have been doing this work for a long, long time, and all he did was use his moment of shine to direct the spotlight towards the folks doing the real work. And that's what I think Van is very good at. Anybody that knows Van know that he's a man of many passions. So I helped Van out in New Orleans at the Essence Festival, working on STEM classes and coding classes for youth. You know, Hack the Hood and all these other nonprofits from Oakland were there, for instance, not green related. And then from there, he's you know, I think famously been working with Kim Kardashian on, you know, incarceration legislation, which is actually what he started in before he got into green stuff. So he's a man of many passions, and I think that's why Bezos gave him that $100 million, is because he knows that Van is one of those men, as they say, that is in touch with the zeitgeist. You know, he knows all the hot button issues, and he's got something to say about all of them. Folks like myself, who are a little bit more single track minded, have been at this green stuff for a long time, and you know, we're very thankful for him bringing the attention to this issue for the time that he did. But just to bring it home, you know, and in terms of getting back to what you were talking about, how we can leverage this on the ground across the country. You know, I think the argument has to continue to be made that those who were the victims of things from the Industrial Revolution, like coal and nuclear. You know, I sat on the board of a nonprofit called the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, for instance, down in New Orleans, where we sued refineries on behalf of fence line neighbors. These are people who have cancer and literally whose homes have blown up because gas lines were underneath their homes and they did not know it. You know, these are folks who paid the price, black and brown folks. And if you go city by city, state by state, the story is the same. Our community was on the front lines of the Industrial Revolution. We suffered so that this country could prosper in so many different ways, you know.
On that note, you know, sadly, I lost a niece. Her name was Aja Cloud. That's my mother's name. Aja was an up-and-coming star. She had just graduated from Bowie State and with a degree in journalism. But unfortunately, she had an asthma attack at a graduation party and dropped dead and left us. So I tell that story to let people understand that we're not talking about something that's just affecting old folks like myself, baby boomers, or middle-aged folks. Asthma is nothing but an environmental condition that it happens because of the carcinogens that are in the air. NAACP Legal Defense Fund has put out report after report after report within any 75 miles of any community of color in the United States. You have some type of incinerary or coal-burning plant. And these things have raised havoc nationwide in the industrial, as you said, as part of the Industrial Revolution, building cars, building the technologies, and we've been to our communities from the lower property values to health, property values, health issues, you name it, it has affected our communities, but we've been the least to be considered to be talked to and not about. And I use that term, talk to and not about, because I am also president of the National Association of Blacks in Solar. And we've been organizing all of our African-American solar installation, design, EV, and workforce development companies under one umbrella to get Donald McGeechan, who's the whip for the CBC, and Bobby Rush, to help us with Benny Thompson, my vice president of the organization, Mr. Will Shirley, president of Sundial Solar, the only African-American in the whole entire state of Mississippi that owns a solar installation and design firm. We've been at this. Brother, you have laid down and pointed out information that people need to hear. I don't know how much more I can say how important the knowledge that you bring to the table, Mr. John Moore. But Brother Moore, it's been a pleasure having you to don this airways of solar now and the future with this economic impact on Black America. So is there anything you would like to say in closing to our listening audience? Because you had me going, man, and I didn't even take a pause for the call for 30 minutes in. Normally I'll let people know that I'm paying for this show out of my pocket. How valuable the information is. So could you please let people know how people can get in contact with you and what you're doing right now and closing out? Because we're right down to the end of the show, because I didn't program it for any more than 60 minutes today, and I wanted to make sure that I gave you this full hour. So go right ahead.
Well, yeah, man, I appreciate you having me. I'm easy to find, John Moore, on LinkedIn or my email, jgmoore1982@gmail. You can always find me. I am very active in this space. Currently, I'm consulting for a company called Energia, and we're working on a crowdsourced solar funding model that I think is going to really blow the hood off the whole community solar program and platform. And I encourage everybody to take a look at Energia. You can actually invest, just like with Robinhood and all these other apps. You can get a piece of the action yourself. I think, you know, just to kind of bring home our whole conversation.
I had Mike and Mrs. Felicia Davis on last week. So if people want to hear about Energia, they can just look at last week's show. Okay?
Okay.
So I had them on last week. That's why I wanted to follow up with you next, because I know how valuable you are and what you bring to the table, brother. And I want to thank you for the work that you're doing in this renewable energy sector. Because believe
Definitely.
Me, when you said you don't see many of us in this space, there's not that many of us in this space, and especially with people who have established a networking of contacts that we can, what we can say, can get things done. Because it ain't what you know, it's who you know that's willing to.
That's facts.
Don't mean a damn thing. And that's
that
what
is
we call
fact.
Real talk. And with that being said, once again, John, would you give out that contact information again?
You can email me, jgmoore1982@gmail.com. Or find me on LinkedIn, John Moore.
Yeah. And John, please send this show to a Van and let him know that we'd like to talk to him about getting some help so we can get this show up on the Urban One Radio Network, because this show needs to be heard in 76 Mark. Our people need to hear the John Moores in this world, my brother. And that's...
Indeed.
That's real talk. Okay, thank you very
much, brother.
I'll
get you in contact with Green 4 All right away. I can make that happen.
All right, brother. Thank you very much, John. Ladies and gentlemen,
thank you.
We're out of time now. But as we say every week, we want you to go in peace. But remember, love many, trust few. Learn to paddle your own canoe. Trust but verify. That's what everything you do. You love people to death, but verify what they give it you and do your own research and homework. And with that being said, for next week, we said, we don't want you to meet us back here. We want you to meet us back here. And that was John Moore. Until next week, we said go in peace.
Someone singing, I can tell, sing it. Life is a song worth singing, why don't you sing it? You hold the key in the palm of your hand, use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan, change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.